On this week's 51%, the family gatherings have begun, and we take a look at the state of the Family Leave Act in California. Then, a woman who cares about New York City children in foster care seeks to broaden their horizons by exposing them to the arts.
This young woman who had suffered so much said that my choice to spend time with her made her feel important.
And we make a toast to the original Champagne Lady. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
California's Family Leave Act is a step ahead of the U.S. as a whole in giving all parents the right to some time off, but it's complicated. There is a patchwork of federal and state regulations that dictates who takes time off work to be home with a newborn. Combined, there are at least 6 different laws that new parents should know about. KALW Cross Currents reporter Lisa Bartfy has more.
All right, now the bathroom's ready. Let's go.
7 o'clock is bath time for 14-month-old Ryan. His dad, David Lee, gently washes his hair.
Ryan, you stuck food in your hair, so we have to wash it. Sorry.
Lee and his wife are friends of mine, and watching these two working parents struggle to stay financially afloat and spend time with their baby made me wonder how they do it all.
Just don't drink your bath water.
Lee, who didn't want to use his real name for fear of offending his former employer, was working at Google when he became a dad. The company is known for having excellent parental benefits, but that didn't help Lee when he wanted to be home with his baby.
I was a contractor at Google, so I had no paternity leave at all.
To be included under the federal work protection laws, you have to have been an employee for at least a year. Although Lee worked at Google for over 2 years, his contract was only for 9 months at a time.
But, you know, I really wanted to stay home with my son. Family is always more important to me. My job is a job. You can move around. Even you can switch careers if you wanted to.
There still aren't that many men who take parental leave. So if your employer doesn't spell it out for you, there's no clear path to follow. But luckily, another dad at Google helped Lee figure out that he could get 4 weeks of paid leave.
He was in a desk right next to mine, so we talked about it.
Lee's friend told him about California's paid family leave program, which gives new parents up to 6 weeks of partial pay, as much as 55% of weekly wages, to bond with their babies. This gets paid through the EDD, Employment Development Department, so no matter where you work, you're still eligible for that money.
I had originally thought I wasn't really eligible for anything.
Lee's wife, Emily Yip, works as a lawyer at a small practice in San Francisco. She also wasn't clear on what kind of parental leave she could get. So she asked around at work and ended up finding someone in the payroll department who could answer her questions.
She looked through the manual, which I did not have, and she said, oh yes, you do get 3 weeks of paid leave from the firm. So, I mean, that's something that I probably wouldn't have known about unless I had asked. And no one would have known to give it to me unless I had asked.
Yip was able to cobble together 11 to 12 weeks of some paid leave. She took out sick days and vacation days on top of the 3 weeks her firm offered. It was only later that she realized she could have had 2 more weeks of paid leave.
You know, I usually am pretty good at reading forms and information and gleaning what I need to from it, but I just, you know, it just wasn't said in plain English.
Yip practices family law. It's her job to make sense of forms and rules like this. If they're hard for her to understand, then they're completely illegible for many other parents, if they even know about them. I meet Sandra Ruiz at Bananas, a childcare resource center in Oakland.
Oh, is that baby clothes?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm wearing the big kids' clothes then.
She's looking through some used baby clothes for her four-month-old daughter in their on-site boutique. A lot of the families that come here are low income and struggling to make ends meet after having kids.
Well, I did have a stable job, and then I got pregnant, so I had to leave. I was really nauseous. I couldn't stand the smell of the food since I worked in a fast food place.
But Ruiz didn't have to quit just because of morning sickness. Most Californians pay into the state disability insurance, and that makes them eligible for time off before and after the birth of a baby. This is an important part of the Family Leave Act, but people just don't know about it. Ruiz stays at home with her daughter now, while her boyfriend works at the glass shop. She would like to work. She's always earned her own money, but she says it's hard.
What makes it hard? Trying to have someone to look after my baby, somebody I could trust, and being able to afford a babysitter.
Her boyfriend would love to spend more time at home with the baby.
But it's like he wants to be there more than just the weekends. Sometimes he calls in so he could, you know, spend time with us, but it's like a once a month thing.
But Reese's boyfriend can't be with the baby unless he gets paid time off work.
She runs through formula, diapers, baby wipes really quick. And she's growing at a really quick rate, so it's like all this baby clothes, it's going out the door, and it's not much coming in.
So they're stuck in a situation where Ruiz can't work at all, and her boyfriend works too much. And they're still struggling financially.
I think that the reality for most two-parent households is that both need to work. Certainly single parents, they're the only income, so that's a requirement. It's just a fact of life.
Judy Krigge is the program director at Bananas. She says out of all the families she works with, very few are taking the family leave that they're entitled to.
Very rarely occasions when it comes to a family emergency, usually a medical emergency.
Krigge blames this on some deeply ingrained cultural ideals.
There's this kind of pull yourself up by your bootstrap mentality in our not just our state, but as a country as a whole. So I think there's just a lot of negative associations with families taking advantage of a benefit that they actually have the right to.
These negative associations are nothing new, according to Caroline Fredrickson, lawyer and author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. And she says that makes it difficult for many parents.
You know, been very reluctant to think about universal solutions to what are really universal problems. And instead, you know, each individual woman is supposed to struggle herself to figure out how to deal with what every other woman practically, and man too, is dealing with around her, which is, how do I make sure that I have enough time for my family and I earn enough money to support them?
Fredrickson says the state needs to do a better job of informing workers.
And, you know, and the other piece is that, you know, in the United States, it's not a given and that workers would have what is a right in virtually every other country in the world, which is to some kind of paid family leave. And so I think, unfortunately, people's basic assumption is they shouldn't look for it because it's most likely not there.
Many jobs these days don't come with the benefits or protections that most people might expect. There's been an outrage recently about Uber and Lyft drivers who are considered contractors and don't get things like sick days. But Fredrickson says this is nothing new.
This is an old song that has been sung for a long time, but it has particularly afflicted low-wage workers and very much low-wage women workers.
Fredrickson calls the U.S. a nation of contingency, as more contingent workers get into contingent situations, always on the edge of disaster.
And in fact, having a child is one of the things that's most associated with a plunge into deep poverty. Instead of having a safety net in place to ensure that children and their families have the basics, have health care and have a place to live and have a means of ensuring that they have food and the other basic necessities of life. But as it is now, it's a risky economic proposition for people who are already struggling to think about having a family.
It's a risky proposition, even for people up the income ladder. People like my friends, Emily Yip and David Lee.
Okay. Let's get you dry.
Bath time is over for baby Ryan, and Lee and his wife are putting him to bed. Lee wants to make sure that he can do that every night. With or without pay, staying at home with his son was something Lee felt like he had to do.
Not had to do as in, you know, some sort of societal obligation, but just for myself, I wanted to bond with my son. In my own case, my parents left me when I was very young, I think at 8 months old.
Lee's parents left him in China, where his grandparents took care of him. He says he didn't get to know his parents until the age of 6, and he wanted a different experience with his own son.
So it was very important that I, you know, got to take care of him while he's young. You know, they're not that age forever. And just watch him grow up. So I stayed home.
Staying home with a new baby is a rare privilege for many parents these days. But maybe it shouldn't be. Spending time together in those first months is important for the well-being of both parents and kids. California's paid family leave policy is starting to address that, but a lot of families are still falling through the cracks. For Cross Currents, I'm Lisa Bartfai.
We now turn to our 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She resides in California's Napa Valley and is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom. As a freelance journalist, she blogs for the Huffington Post, and this week she interviews Lynn Tansman, a former communications and strategic marketing executive who is passionate about working with New York City children in need. Tansman founded Culture for One, a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving the lives of children in foster care by providing cultural experiences and exposure to a broader world. Ufberg asked Tansman about her motivation to provide children in foster care access to the arts.
I had an exciting career, and then I became motivated to find an opportunity to connect with children and do something that really matters. I was inspired to use my talent, and I wanted to express who I am. I care deeply about children, and I believe personally that if we are successful, it's our responsibility to help others who are not. And I felt that it was important for me to start in my own backyard. So I looked at the problems facing New York City children, and I learned that those in foster care were the most in need, and I saw both a problem and a void that I could help fill. These kids simply lacked opportunities that are critical to their development. I had a lot of exposure to culture growing up. It brought me both joy and it helped me identify my interests. So as I move past more material accomplishments, I'm now at a stage in my life where the quality of my life and my connections to others are my priority. And I was fortunate enough to take two things that I love, culture and children, and bring them together in order to make a difference.
I know that you have so many children that you touch each year, and you must have some incredible stories about the difference that it makes when they do become, you know, exposed to some of these incredible opportunities that you offer in New York. New York has everything, and it's it would be so great if you could just share at least one of those stories that kind of reflects the kind of impact your work is having with the children that you touch.
I'd be happy to. We use the arts as a vehicle to connect with the kids. So it's not about them becoming artists. It's about engaging them. An example of Culture for One's work and impact is the story of one teen who was removed from a dangerous, abusive home. She spent 12 years in foster care, which included a period of couch surfing as a runaway. We initially connected by sharing a Broadway show and then talking for hours over a meal. This is how we met and how we started a relationship. she told me that she thought Culture for One was a good idea because, as she said, the arts make kids think about things differently. And just as importantly, she said, kids in foster care feel that no one cares about them. And finally, that they rarely get opportunities like this to spend time with an outsider, outside the system, and to see something beautiful and inspiring. This young woman who had suffered so much said that my choice to spend time with her made her feel important. It helped her to begin to see that there are people that think she's wonderful and want to help her have the best life possible. We provided her with a range of positive experiences, going to the ballet, going to the museum, spending time one-on-one, seeing shows, and visiting different companies. These experiences helped build her confidence, which was really lacking. It exposed her to new possibilities. And we really encouraged her to pursue a personal interest. And at the same time, we introduced her to role models. She had a very difficult period in her life, and we supported her when she was really struggling. And when she had a critical need in order for her to move forward towards a fulfilling, independent life that was beyond the system, we stepped in and helped her get that peace. And our relationship continues. She's aged out of foster care. But she is now healthier and happier and more capable than when we first met her. She's in college on her way to become a physician's assistant, and her goal is to help other people.
That is such a beautiful story, and I'm sure you have hundreds of stories very much like that. I think to just get a sense of the difference you're making, I would love if you could share, if you know them, some of the current statistics of how many foster kids are actually in the system in New York City, and also if you know how many, let's say, this year that you were able to reach.
Nationally, there are nearly 400,000 children in foster care. In New York City alone, there are 11,000 children in the foster care system, and about 1,000 age out of the system each year. We, this year, will touch the lives of about 800 children, offering over 1,000 different arts opportunities. We have a lot of kids who spend a lot of time with us. They're repeat participants, and that allows us to develop a relationship with them because, unfortunately, most kids spend more time in foster care than they should and that is healthy for them.
Thank you so much. Lynn Tansman for Culture for One. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
And for more information, you may visit cultureforone.org. That's one spelled out. During the Great Depression, her voice lifted spirits. During the Big Band era, her beauty radiated from the stage of St. Paul's Prom Ballroom. But Lois Best Herman will best be remembered as bandleader Lawrence Welk's original Champagne Lady. In October, Herman died at the age of 98, and KFAI's Britt Ahmet has a look back.
5 months have gone by since I last spoke to the people of the nation about the state of the nation.
Imagine it's the Great Depression. It is the Great Depression. 1938. Worn shoe heels, retread tires, a little less sugar in the pound cake. And in a spare moment, you drop the needle on a 78. And this voice comes out of the speaker that is everything the Depression is not.
People call him Lovin' Sam. He's the Sheik of Alabama. He's a mean
joyous, elegant, bubbly. That voice belonged to Lois Best Herman, Lawrence Welk's first champagne lady, who died October 28th in Mendota Heights, Minnesota. She was 98.
My mom was born in Courtney, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Pittsburgh, 1917.
Bonnie Herman is one of Herman's four children with bandleader Jules Herman.
She started singing as a child. She played the piano. She taught piano lessons as a teenager, played for all the choirs in her high school. And she had a five-minute broadcast on KDKA, which was a big radio station where she played and sang. And then she started singing professionally in small bands in the area.
That was 1938. And an ambitious band leader and accordion player from North Dakota had just flown into Pittsburgh for an engagement at the William Penn Hotel. His name was Lawrence Welk. And he heard the 18-year-old Lois Best sing and asked his trumpet player, Jules Herman, to go with him later and check out the singer's act.
If you dopey walk, you double talk, I go for that. You corny jokes, you dizzy folks, I go for that.
He offered her a contract. Herman talked about that life-changing moment in 1993 when she was inducted in the Minnesota Music Hall of Fame.
My father fixed my contract with Welk. Laura said, should we have a no-marriage contract? And I was a little insulted because I was so career-minded. I said, oh, no. Lawrence was a very kind of fatherly guy, and he asked my dad, Jules Herman, who was the first trumpet player in the band just out of college, to be chaperone along with another band member, to, you know, chaperone her around shopping, going to movies, making sure she was safe and having her dinners on time and all that. And they got married about 6 months later.
Toodle-oo-ma-loo-ma, toodle-oo-ma-loo-ma, toodle-i-ay. Any umbrellas, any umbrellas to
Lois Best Herman holds a special place in Lawrence Welk history. She wasn't the first female singer, but she was the first one to hold the title of Champagne Lady, the tuneful embodiment of the Lawrence Welk Orchestra's sound, which a dancer is credited as saying was as light and bubbly as champagne. By 1940, the young couple had left the Lawrence Welk tour to settle in Chicago and raise a family. But a decade later, they pulled up stakes and moved to the Twin Cities, where the Jules Herman Orchestra was the house band at St. Paul's famous Prom Ballroom for 35 years. Jules and Lois retired in 1996, and Jules died in 2005. But daughter Bonnie Herman, a Chicago-based singer, and her son, guitarist Johnny Radke, carry on the family tradition.
My mom, she was such a showman. If you look at her videos, the Paramount videos that are on YouTube, she was just, you know, 18, and she just had no fear. She just loved entertaining. And at the end of her life, you know, this past week, she was telling me that she was just so grateful that she could bring so much happiness to people, because people, you know, when they come out at night, especially to dance, it's a happy environment. And they brought a lot of happiness to people. And at the end of her life, she was really, really happy that she'd done that for people.
But I fell up to heaven when I fell in love with you.
This is Britt Amit for KFAI.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1375.